Kia ora koutou, da jia hao. Welcome back to the New Zealand China Council podcast for 2024. I'm Alistair Crozier, the Executive Director of the Council. In this podcast, we welcome back a good friend of the podcast and a friend of the New Zealand China Council, Associate Professor Jason Young. Jason leads the Contemporary China Research Centre at Victoria University in Wellington and is an expert analyst and commentator on Chinese politics and contemporary China generally. This time round, Jason and I tackle a topic that could potentially be a bit dry, but hopefully we'll ensure it's not, namely the two sessions, or Lianghui, two high-level meetings that are held in Beijing in March every year, essentially kicking off the Chinese system's work for the coming 12 months, once everyone comes back from their Lunar New Year break. For observers, the Lianghui can send important signals about what China will focus on in the year to come at a macro level, which then trickles down and permeates through the system. In other words, we ignore the two sessions at our peril. I hope you enjoy the discussion. Jason, welcome back to the podcast. The last time we had a chat about Chinese political issues was around the time of the Communist Party Congress. But today you've kindly agreed to share your knowledge and insights on what's known as the two sessions, or the Lianghui, that take place every year in Beijing around this time. So thank you for joining us. I'd like to start with a very basic 101 question. What are the two bodies that hold their plenary meetings every year at this time? And what do they focus on?
So thanks, Alistair. It's great to be back. I always enjoy these conversations. So the Lianghui, or the two meetings, is the annual meeting of two of China's most important bodies. The first one being the National People's Congress, which is the legislature in China. And then the second one is the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, which is quite a mouthful and is a political advisory body. And that's really more of a hangover from before the National People's Congress was established, and is mainly a consultation body. So the NPC, or the National People's Congress, is the highest body of state power. It generally passes laws, reviews the government work program, and also appoints the State Council, which is basically the cabinet, a very large cabinet of China. And I think the way I like to think of them, in really sort of simple terms, is that the NPC implements policy in China, passes laws, reviews the government work program, and then the CPPCC is more about consultation and is largely performative in the sense that it brings together lots of different groups within China. In political science, they're called functional groups. Representatives of the military, representatives of the Nomingong, or the migrant workers, representatives of different ethnic groups, representatives of different classes in society. And there they are to provide feedback, which is then passed over to the NPC and then on to the bigger, larger, more important body, which is, of course, the Party Congress.
Well, thanks for the clear intro into that. Fundamentally, at the apex of the NPC, you've got the same individuals that are also at the apex of the party and also at the apex of the state, I guess, of the government. So that leads some people to conclude that the NPC is just a rubber stamping body and so on. Is that a fair assessment, or do you see some sort of clearer separation of powers than that at the top level of the Chinese system?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think it's shifted over time. So as you know, in China, they have a system where you have, they call it Lianghui Paizi, Yige Jigou. So you have sort of two name cards and one organization. And it's very similar at the top of Chinese politics, where the same people have the same roles within the Chinese Communist Party and within the Party Congress as they do in the National People's Congress. But I think it's actually kind of almost a division of activity. So policy is debated, discussed, decided within the Party Congress and within the Chinese Communist Party. And then I see the NPC and the state, the government, is more about implementation. In recent years, it's been more clearly signaled. So in the 1980s and 1990s, there was a lot of debate and discussion about a clearer distinction between the party and the state. Whereas in recent years, I think there's been a coherent body of work that's been trying to sort of put them back together and have the party be seen as the clear political organization within China. So this year's government work report, the first line in it says that 2023 was the first year for fully implementing the guiding principles from the 20th National Congress of the Communist Party of China. We're basically saying that it's clear the government's job is to implement the guiding principles that the party puts forth. You can also see similar types of statements within the constitution as well. So I think rubber stamp is a bit too much of a shorthand, but it's rather, I would suggest it's more of an implementation body for decisions which are made within the party.
Yeah, look, I'd agree with that as well. But it is, you know, fundamentally an extremely useful snapshot every year of what China's focuses are going to be for the coming 12 months, where they're going to put emphasis, which is very helpful, obviously, for observers. The CPPCC is an interesting one. I'm not going to try the full title like you did, but I used to think it was a bit of a fig leaf, really, in that, you know, this whole purporting to consult with a country of 1.4 billion people is pretty difficult. And it was good to have the body there, but what did it really do? But in recent years, I've changed my views a little bit, because this is my 25th year, I just realized the other day, of reading these reports and following the Lianhui. And you begin to realize that even though it's not a democratic system in the way that we understand a mandate of the people to lead and to rule, you know, the Chinese leaders still need it, still need a mandate from the people. And so, in fact, the CPPCC is a gathering point for views from a wide range of sectors on different issues, including issues that are maybe potential to become irritants in the relationship between the leaders and the led. So in a way, it's a little bit like a public consultation process in New Zealand. It's not that every suggestion is going to be taken up and acted on, but some potentially will be. And it's a good opportunity for the Chinese leadership to see where there are real pressure points that they may have to address. And I know this year there's been some proposals from CPPCC members. The one that I noticed was one to increase the minimum threshold for paying income tax, that suddenly get a lot of focus on social media and there's a buzz around them. And I'm sure at some level, those in power in Beijing do look at these trends and these issues and again, maybe pluck two or three, whether it's from entrepreneurs or from leading sports people or from academics, and they do make their way into policy. So maybe I've had too much coffee this morning, but I've renewed my views on the CPPCC over the years.
Yeah, I would agree that it's, firstly, I think it's a really interesting body. As you describe, it's sort of, the role of it is to provide consultation and feedback in many ways from a whole range of different sectors. I think there's still some question about whether or not that is a sort of a performative act, as in sort of demonstrating that there is sort of social buy-in and engagement in the policymaking process. And there is some evidence, like some of the things you were just mentioning. Also, I think Jia Qingguo, who's a very famous international relations scholar in China, often puts forth ideas about how there needs to be more engagement between academics in China and academics abroad. So there's that one side of it. And then the other side of it is how effective is it at actually getting into the policy making process in China? And that's where it becomes really hard to know, because the policy making process in China is largely a closed book. And we get very few indications, even in the media, about, you know, what the key debates are and what the different voices are. And I think that's a real challenge for people like us that are trying to follow these policy debates.
Sure. Look, I guess some sectoral groups in New Zealand probably feel the same in some ways about our process. But yeah, take the point. So just returning to the NPC, which of the two sessions, of the two bodies, that's the one really that gets most attention every year. One of the key jewels in the crown for the week that it's on is the report on the work of government that's delivered by the Premier, which in this year is Li Qiang. This is the first year he's presented the work report, because last year it was still Li Keqiang in his last days in office. So, you know, everyone pores over this. I don't know if you've read it cover to cover, but I had a go. I just wondered for you, Jason, what stood out this year? What were the key surprises or maybe most significant signals for the year to come?
Yeah, so the key thing I got from it was, I guess the message is that it's steady as she goes, right? This is not a a strong break with what's been happening over the last few terms, that they're going to continue moving in the direction that they have been moving, particularly in terms of economic and socioeconomic policy, and that there was an effort to explain some of the challenges that China's had economically over the last year or so, that was largely put down to what was described as China's external environment becoming more complex, severe, and uncertain. So there was that overt recognition that some of the geopolitics and some of the, particularly for a New Zealand audience, quite concerning economic trends that are happening in the world were having an impact. I thought that it was quite disciplined in the sense that it didn't put forth a large sort of stimulus package similar to what we saw following the global financial crisis. And, you know, there's a debate about whether or not China should be trying to stimulate the economy in the way that it did after the GFC or not. And I thought it also put forth a pretty realistic expectation about growth at around 5%. I also thought that one of the key focuses was on sort of a continuation on the structural transformation of the economy, with a huge focus on emphasizing education, science, and technology, and that those new types of industries as being what are now described as the new quality productive forces. So the idea that this is a transition from an old economic model to a newer economic model. We're not going to stimulate the economy and try to promote consumption. We're going to do the hard yards and try to work our way through that. And, you know, there's a big debate about whether or not that's the right approach for China, and about whether or not there should be a little bit more stimulus to sort of improve confidence and improve people's expectations within China so that consumption could increase. So those are some of the things that stood out for me.
Yeah, and look, lots we could get into in more detail there. But I agree with your first point. There was no indication that the Chinese leadership had its head in the sand. They were very open and realistic about the challenges that have been faced, not just the external ones and this unusually complex international environment, but also domestically, very clear-eyed, you know, saying things like the foundation for China's sustained economic recovery and growth is not solid enough, and talking about lack of demand and overcapacity in some industries and low public expectations. They know what they're up against, and they identified issues such as, you know, local government debt and other current challenges as well, but the property sector, things like that, that had to be overcome. I think, again, similar to yourself, the setting of a fairly ambitious GDP growth target of around 5%, which is similar to what they achieved last year, but without what a commentator I read described as sort of bazooka stimulus to really, which they could, you know, they could do whatever they want, and they could certainly have signaled some exciting stimulus packages. But to decide that they're going to do it the tough way, in a sense, and actually rely on continuing systemic reforms and keep things pretty tight and still try to obtain 5%, that's the challenge, isn't it? And I know a range of commentators have said, well, they're probably not going to be able to do it. But, you know, good on them for trying to keep things tight. And I guess taking some medicine that some people would say has been long overdue in the Chinese system in some of these systemic imbalances. And then with the so-called new productive forces that you mentioned, again, it makes a lot of sense. You know, this progressive evolution of the Chinese economy from being the world's largest factory, just reproducing things, to a more creative and innovative economy that is leading on development of new technologies and digitization and manufacturing focused on, you know, intelligent technologies and low carbon technologies. I guess the issue there is that's going to take time. And as our friends at Trivium China put it, it's still a sort of campaign style program for now. They're going to have to flesh out how you get from A to B while still trying to keep the show on the road with the rest of the economy while you transition. So I think it will be tough. When I was last in China 10 years ago, innovation was sort of seeded into Chinese system in a similar way. And you just saw everyone grip it up and everyone ran with it. And you got to the stage where property development companies were establishing incubators and hubs where I was in Chengdu, because that was what you did, you know, to show that you were on board with innovation. But it was so scattergun and untargeted that in the end you worried that there might be a little bit of wastage, I guess. So I have noticed President Xi and the top leaders speaking to different provinces saying, do this the intelligent way, focus on how you can really make progress with these big goals rather than just throwing everything at it and hoping that something sticks.
Yeah, I think there's been some big successes in China in terms of this approach, in particular the electric vehicles, renewable energies. And the irony is, I think that the successes are also sort of the seed of potential further geostrategic challenges in the sense of there's a lot of commentary coming out of Europe and also out of the US in terms of overcapacity in these sectors and then exporting them. And then there's been a few industries that have just not got off the ground. And thinking the sort of commercial aircraft industries are potentially in the future, but as you state, it's a really long-term type of approach. I think the other side of it is that many maturing economies, there's this natural rebalancing of investment and consumption. And so in the Chinese case, that hasn't actually happened. It seems that the push is still on, that the majority of Chinese financial resources should be going into building new industries and sort of breaking into these high-tech sectors. And I do wonder how long that will continue without that sort of growth in Chinese consumption as a share of GDP. And I think that's also one of the sort of underlying tensions with trade and investment between the advanced other economies around the world. And also potentially is a bit of a question for Chinese households themselves that want to continue prospering in the new China.
Yeah. Yes, well, certainly expanding domestic demand is one of the key priorities noted in the work report. But yes, you're right. The policy response so far seems to have been fairly muted. There's a new sort of trade-in scheme for electrical goods and cars that's been rolled out. But I'm not sure that's really going to do what you're suggesting is needed. But I was interested in the work report. They spoke with some pride that now 60% of global EV output and sales is originating from China. Their 5G penetration rate is over 50%. And interestingly, renewable energy installed capacity has overtaken thermal installed capacity for the first time ever. So that gradual transition towards cleaner energy seems to be taking hold. And on your point about aviation, you know, they noted the successful launch and development of the new C919 aircraft. So every year there seems to be some cumulative progress forward. But yes, it really is just aligning that with the rest of the economy and consumption, I guess, going forward. I also wanted, while we're just still on the work report, to talk a little bit about what was said on foreign trade. I don't know if you focused on that at all, but sometimes these days, as a result, I think, of the promulgation of the dual circulation economy model, there's sometimes some talk that China is turning in on itself and more focused now on just its domestic consumption. But there was quite a lot said about and a priority given to higher standard opening up and foreign trade as well.
Yeah, so I would also see that as a continuation of the discussion that's been going on, policies that have been going on over the last decade or so, where I think there's a recognition in Chinese policymaking that it's not a question of autarky versus complete openness, but there's somewhere in the middle that there needs to be both a way of engaging and being open and trading with the outside world, but at the same time, not being vulnerable in certain choke point industries. So the focus in the tech sector, as you would imagine, such as around chips and semiconductors and other sort of strategically important industries, is to have a bit more self-reliance. And that self-reliance is sort of driven by the geopolitics, which I think are very, very clear. And you see a similar debate coming out of the United States and to a lesser degree also in Europe. And that's regrettably the trend of the global economy that we're experiencing. But I think, as you suggest, the dual circulation discussion was, I think, largely misinterpreted as China will become more autarkic and focus purely on the domestic economy. I think it's more about China trying to be a bit more focused on the types of trade and high quality trade and the types of trade that will be beneficial for the Chinese economy, rather than sort of not trading or trying to build up its own domestic capacities.
Yes, good point. And I was interested also that China's ambition to join the CPTPP and the Digital Economic Partnership Agreement were both mentioned. There's sometimes an analysis that there's two schools of camp in the Chinese system, that some people favour that kind of engagement and opening up, and perhaps others are more conservative. But the fact that it's made it into the work report just underlines again that China is genuinely keen to join these agreements, these trade groupings. And again, sometimes the criticism you hear that China's walking away from the global trade system, I think is unfair. I think they are genuine in their desire. They know the standards to join both those agreements are very high. But we have seen before that they've used, for example, accession to the WTO to really drive a series of domestic reforms that were necessary to meet the standards then. And perhaps they have a similar driver in mind for these agreements as well.
Yeah, so I was in China last year around about November, December. I had a series of academic discussions, and everybody we talked to, they all mentioned the CPTPP and China's bid to become a member of the CPTPP. I think the sort of the trade question is an interesting one in terms of those sort of 21st century type trade agreements. Really positive to see China wanting to join plurilateral agreements and also maintaining quite a positive focus on the WTO and the importance of the international global trading system. I do think there's a lot more room for discussions between sort of liberal market economies and the Chinese system, which is, I'm not saying it's a command economy and I'm not saying it's a market economy, it's sort of something a little bit different. And I think some of those differences need to be worked out and better articulated in terms of global trade if we want to maintain this larger global trading system as being open and inclusive, which I think is very much in the interests of a country like New Zealand.
Well, certainly that's part of the challenge ahead on the CPTPP road, and no one's saying it's going to be at all easy. And obviously there's the views of the existing members as well. But good to know that there's something of a full court press now gathering around their ambitions. I guess just segueing through into other outwards looking topics, one of the other main features of the Lianhui every year of the MPC is key personnel appointments. And in particular, there was a lot of speculation leading up to the meeting that a new foreign minister would be appointed. So last year, Minister Chen Gang left the post and there was a vacancy, and Wang Yi stepped back into the role that he had held previously. And there was a feeling that maybe a new foreign minister would be announced, but that didn't happen. In fact, we're recording this on a Friday, and last night in New Zealand, it was announced that Minister Wang Yi would be visiting New Zealand shortly. So he's still very much the foreign minister of China. Were you expecting a new appointment, or is this no surprise to you?
Well, I'd love to say it was no surprise, but I've kind of kept my expectations for my own ability to predict what will happen in terms of personnel appointment in China pretty low. I guess I was hoping that a new foreign minister would be appointed, which is in no way a criticism of Wang Yi, but rather really just sort of a slow burning concern that succession within the Chinese system is becoming harder and people seem to be staying longer. And just as in New Zealand, I think it's always good to have this rejuvenation of people in important and high stress and a lot of work positions. I think that would also be good within the Chinese system. I also think it is slightly not traditional in the Chinese system to have Wang Yi having two of the key foreign affairs positions. And I think that it would be good to once again split that. So the Minister of Foreign Affairs, which is the government appointed minister, and then also him being the director of the Office of Foreign Affairs Commission of the CCP, which is an incredibly important position. I did note that there was some speculation around Liu Jianchao, who visited New Zealand, I believe, last year, who's the minister of the CPC International Office, about him taking the role. And yet again, you know, it's like with a lot of Chinese politics, we see a lot of speculation and then something different happens. Again, I think sort of shows just how hard it is to kind of predict what will be happening in the future. And just one other personal appointment Li Shangfu, who also lost his role as the Minister of Defence last year, and then a new Defence Minister, Admiral Dongjun, was appointed in December last year. It was interesting that he didn't really get elevated within the government system as well, which I guess sort of suggests that there is a key group of people within the Chinese system taking care of foreign affairs and defence. And you know, just as Li Chang didn't get to have his presser, sort of going against the tradition there, it was interesting that Wang Yi did get a presser, which shows that he has an elevated position within that system.
Yeah, certainly signaled to me that I just assume that the president feels the need for a really experienced, capable pair of hands, and Wang Yi is nothing if not experienced. And, you know, going back again to the official characterization of the international environment at the moment as unusually complex, there's nothing that beats a wise senior leader stepping back in, I suppose. But yes, I take your point about a progressive concentration of power and decision making and few rather than many people at the top. You mentioned the press conference that Wang Yi gave, and that was interesting to me because it was the best readout that I saw on the foreign policy side. And of course, that's of interest to New Zealand as well. Anything there that you felt was unexpected or of significance?
So I agree. I thought it was a really good readout. And I always enjoy seeing Chinese leaders speak in a press conference and speak off the cuff, so to speak. I'm sure they had notes and positions, but I think that's a really positive sign. I think it's really good for China as well to have more of that type of engagement and discussion. I thought that, you know, there were some pretty standard themes about China wanting to play a constructive, positive role in the world, wanting to have a bigger role, sort of the standard calls for dialogue in Ukraine and Gaza, call for dialogue on the South China Sea, discussions about trying to resolve a number of tensions. There was a lot of media about some of the comments on Taiwan.
As always.
As always, yes. No, it's one of those issues. I didn't think he said anything new. I thought that was a pretty standard line. It was strongly put warning against the described as Taiwanese independence, but there was nothing new there. And I thought that, yes, there was criticism of, for example, the United States and what were described as tactics to suppress China. And this was pretty strongly worded, but I still felt that it was a bit warmer, if we can say a criticism can be warmer, than in recent years. And I think that's really a result of the really important meeting last year between Biden and Xi Jinping. And I also felt that when I was in China in November, December last year as well, that really did help stabilize that relationship, which I think is positive for all of us.
Yes, I think that meeting gave China some hope and optimism. I think it was much needed because things have been so grim leading up to that. But yes, Wang Yi did speak at the press conference about despite some progress being made, there was still, as he put it, some US actions that were still targeted against China. And he said at one point, if the US is nervous and anxious whenever it hears the word China, where's the self-confidence of a major country? And that the problems for America, the challenges lie within itself, not with China. So interesting to hear that readout. I thought some of the comments he made about Russia, Ukraine, and drawing on historical experience that the conflicts, if prolonged, tend to deteriorate and escalate beyond what the party has envisioned was an interesting one. But as we know, and as we've seen recently, and I think was either stated by Wang Yi in the press conference or in the work report, you know, the relationship with Russia is still a fundamental one for China overall. And then Taiwan, yes, at least we didn't see comments like not ruling out the use of force being interpreted by media as Beijing was going to invade Taiwan. But yes, there was still a heavy emphasis on reunification, obviously. Some warning shots sounded, but I agree with your overall assessment. There did seem to be a calmer readout on the key foreign policy focus points for China at the moment. Jason, I said at the start, let's do 30 minutes. I think that should do us. And I think it's just so good to talk through this stuff with you. We've already gone over that. But just to conclude, this is now the 2024, is the 75th year of the existence of the People's Republic of China since 1949. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot of stocktaking taking place during the year. But just as we leave this discussion and looking back at what you saw in the Liang Kuei this year, What do you think are going to be the key focus points that you're going to look at for China in the year to come based on what you've heard over the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I guess I would just hazard a guess. I would suggest that one of the key takeaways for me about the key direction that China will be moving in over the next few years is less of a focus on some of those measures which were incredibly important in that sort of fast, rapid growth period of China, which is like GDP, for example, statistics. I think the singular focus on that has gone. And now I think it's more about the industrial structure and about trying to move China up the value chain and into some of those really important emerging technologies and industries that will provide China with long-term growth and economic engagement globally. And so I think that idea of some self-reliance with some engagement internationally and trying to build a high-level industry. And I think there, in terms of, we also see sort of an ongoing focus on development. One of the key words, I think it was, I did a quick word search for it in the work report. It appeared 138 times, I believe. But then there's also another focus on security within that, sort of economic security, but also other broader foreign affairs and security issues. And I think that could potentially play out as a challenge in terms of geopolitics this year, because we also see similar debates and discussions going on in Europe and in the United States in particular. And I think the other thing that I think is a key focus for China, and I was a little bit disappointed that, you know, it did get mentioned in the work report and in the discussions, but I don't think any clear policies were put forward on it, was focusing on strengthening the overall social security system, you know, to deal with some of those longer term problems, demographic problems, and aging workforce, questions around healthcare systems and people's demands in China for a better healthcare system, for more social security, for better pensions, for strengthening the education system, where China is like the world. In Shanghai, the education system is top grade, but if you go to some small villages in China, the education system is still very, very spotty. And so I think in the coming years, there's going to be increasing need for China to put more and to invest more in those sort of wraparound social security systems.
Yeah. Yes, well, again, as we said at the start, the problems have been, I think, well identified. It's really a question of whether the measures that were proposed in response are robust enough to actually deal with them, and that will be the challenge. And so I agree with you that this year, the clarion call has been made where China will aim high, as it always does, for the next level of economic transformation and development, but how to avoid the hard landing in the meantime, while you're aiming for the stars, in a sense, when you've got some immediate pressing issues that they are aware of and that they're working to address as well. So as always, it's going to be another very interesting year. And for me, just a great chance to chat through some of the stuff with you, Jason. Always appreciate it. Thank you very much indeed for joining me. And I'm sure that our listeners will find your thoughts very thought-provoking. So thank you.
Thanks, Alistair. I enjoyed the conversation.
My thanks to Jason Young for another frank and wide-ranging exploration of the Lianhui, which perhaps have a tendency to remain impenetrable without someone like Jason acting as an expert guide for us. We may even do it again next year. To keep up to date on future podcasts, please follow us on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or Spotify, and feel free to sign up to electronic alerts on all our activities through our website, nzchinacouncil.org.nz. Thanks for listening.